Hello everyone, this is Hear the World. My name is Asaf Ophir, and I have been interviewing people from different faiths about what wisdom they have to offer about the coronavirus. And today we're going to be talking about Hinduism. I have the great honor of speaking with Sangeeta Kausik. She's the Hindu chaplain at New York University and also the founder of Ihsan Ishan Design Company. I hope you enjoy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I should have started recording a second ago, but hello. How you doing?
I'm good.
I'm kind of going to jump into a few things. Mm-hmm. So first of all, if you can tell us just a little bit about yourself. You live in New York, right?
I live in New York City, yeah.
You're the chaplain at, what is it, NYU?
At NYU. Mm-hmm. So I've been here for close to 20 years. I was born and raised in Fremont, California. So I left when I was about 18 to come to New York City to study design at Parsons School of Design. So I graduated Parsons and I stayed here ever since, working in design, working in fashion, working for museums. Like, I've worked all over the place, but my focus is design.
Cool. And your family is from India?
Yes, my parents. So my father is from Bangalore and my mother is from Chennai, but they're both South Indian Tamil people. And the funny thing is they met and married in Berkeley, California. So,
That's funny. We got a ding when you said that. I wonder where that came from.
Oh, the ting that went off. I'm so sorry. Yeah, Berkeley, California, ting, yeah.
Well, as a New Yorker and maybe also someone from an Indian background, I wonder if you want to tell us a little bit of what you're seeing when you look out your window as far as the effects of the virus.
Well, see, in New York, it's like I live in Manhattan. I live in the East Village, which is like a very hip neighborhood. So it's like a lot of like hipsters, a lot of students, because NYU and Cooper Union University is close by, lots of restaurants, lots of bars. So since the coronavirus, all of these restaurants and bars have shut down, all the schools have been closed and the students have been sent home. So it's pretty quiet. My neighborhood is very silent, and just some of the grocery stores are open and the pharmacies are open. So it's like the chaos that you hear about in New York City is mostly in Queens and in Brooklyn and in the Bronx. And it's really heartbreaking. It's really devastating because most of the people who are affected by this virus are minority communities, because most of the workers who are deemed essential workers who work in the pharmacies and work in the grocery stores, who work for MTA, they all have to take the subway in. They all have to keep going to their jobs in order to put food on the table and a roof over their head. So unfortunately, these communities have been impacted tremendously. It's really, really sad. So
yeah, it's interesting to think that those jobs, you know, people that live in those neighborhoods are the ones that fill those jobs.
Yeah, because the thing is, like, the wealthier neighborhoods, say I live in a rent stabilized apartment. I have rent stabilization, but New York City, unfortunately, is getting more and more luxury condos. Luxury buildings are opening up, especially in my neighborhood. A lot of churches have had to close down, sell their properties, and like luxury buildings, and nobody can afford Manhattan anymore, really.
Yeah, sure. So similar things are happening, of course, in California. I'm sure you know that.
Yes, people are getting pushed out of the city into Oakland, and even Oakland is getting very expensive.
Yes, very expensive. I actually lived in Oakland until about a year ago, and yeah, it's been very crazy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about Hinduism. What I like to do is ask people if they had to describe their religion or their culture in three words, like to someone who had never heard of it and knew nothing about it. What three words would you choose?
Compassion. Actually, it's a couple of words. Compassion, love, oneness, and diversity. Because Hinduism is very, very diverse in its practice. It's not practiced in just one way, shape, or form. It really depends on your cultural background, your language, and what region of India you came from. But then again, a lot of Hindus there are a lot of Hindus who are not of South Asian origin. I have a lot of Hindu friends who are Chinese or African American or European. So it really depends. Like, Hinduism is vast in its practice, but it preaches oneness, which people find very confusing because there's a multitude of deities.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I mean, what is that? Can you like give us a rough sense of what does that mean for people to be practicing in different ways if it's the same religion?
If it's the same religion. Okay, so I'll tell you this. So Hinduism, there's no historical founder like the three Abrahamic faiths all trace their lineage back to the prophet Abraham. Islam, Christianity, and Judaism all trace their lineage to prophet Abraham. But we do not have one historical figure. And it's in India is almost like 85 different countries put into one. Every few miles, the language changes, or the cultural practices differ, the food changes, the demographics change. And yeah, even the religions change. Religion in India is that every religion on this planet is practiced in India. So Hindu religion, it started millions of years ago. So my parents are Tamil people from the South Indian state of Tamil Nadu, right? It's called essentially the temple state of India because there's over 1,500 Hindu temples in Tamil Nadu, right? So that is the one state that stayed almost predominantly Hindu, though we have a lot of Tamil Christians, a lot of Tamil Muslims as well too, because it was well protected by a mountain range in South India. So it wasn't influenced by any other religions that came down through the mountain pass of the Khyber Pass, right? Which is near Afghanistan. That's where most people, most other cultures and religions came through that pass. But India, because it's protected by South India is protected by a mountain pass. Other religions came through the sea. Like missionaries came through the sea. Muslims came through the sea through trade, missionary work, etc. So Tamil people, they practice very differently than say North Indian people do. And what I mean to say different is that, for example, our deities, if you go into a South Indian temple, if you walk into any of those Hindu temples, most of the statues are made of granite, black granite, because black granite can take a lot of ritualistic practice. Because Hinduism wasn't influenced by other religions, it stayed very pure and very straight by the book. So so South Indian Hinduism is highly ritualistic and follows a lot of the rites and rituals that are written in our scriptures, such as the Rig Veda, the Upanishads, et cetera, et cetera. North India, because they have the Islamic influence, their temples have marble statues. Marble making was brought by the Arabs when they came through the Khyber Pass, bringing Islam and marble making. So those, and so they have a mixed way of practice. I wouldn't say mixed, is they influenced by Islam in a way that, for example, women cover their hair when they enter the temple. South Indians do not cover their hair when they enter a temple.
Interesting.
And it's like they have marble statues, marble erodes. They cannot take so much heavy ritualistic practice as South Indians do. So you're not going to see ritualistic bathing, abhishegam with milk and honey and fruits and yogurt and butter as in the North. You're not going to see that many rituals in the North as you see in the South. The main reason for a multitude of deities is that they all lead to the same divine. They're aspects of the same divine. So I'll say it like this. Suppose your foot hurts. You wouldn't go to a brain doctor because your foot hurts, right? So same thing with these different deities. You want someone to remove your obstacles, pray to Lord Ganesha. You want to pass your exams on your tests, pray to Goddess Saraswati, the goddess of knowledge. You need help on your business, pray to Goddess Lakshmi, the goddess of wealth. So all of these are multiple facets of the same formless, genderless divine. And also another way to look at this is that if you tell a baby, like if you tell a five-year-old child to pray to God, he has no idea what God is or what it looks like. You give him a beautiful image of of Ganesh, a cute little elephant god, or Hanuman, a cute little monkey god, or a beautiful goddess like Parvati, or a Devi, he has something to focus his energy and his love on. So it's like that love and that respect and that devotion for God will be, he'll train himself through this love that he, and affection he feels for this particular deity. And then as he gets older, he's not going to need external elements. It's almost as if you are training yourself to feel the divine within you. It's God. God is divine. God is omnipresent. Nobody has seen God's face. He can be anything you want him to be. He's overpowering. He's all-powering, all-encompassing.
Mm. It's interesting. It's interesting to hear you say that after having, you know, when I traveled through India and you see so many representations of God and you see so many pictures, and a lot of them, you know, like the picture of Krishna is kind of blue, many times a blue child. And almost anyone who's a bit familiar with the culture will see a blue picture and say, oh, okay, that's Krishna. You know, we recognize him. And then to hear you say that at the same time, God is also seen as formless. It's a very interesting perspective on that.
You're familiar with what the Bhagavad Gita is, right?
Yeah. I happen to have read it. Yes, it's beautiful.
So the interesting thing about the Bhagavad Gita is most Westerners say that the Bhagavad Gita is our Bible, which is not the truth because we have multiple books. The Bhagavad Gita, if you look at art history, for example, there are no artistic depictions, meaning sculpture or painting or written or illustrated accounts of the Bhagavad Gita before the 17th century, before the British arrived in India. Essentially, they couldn't make sense of everyone worshiping various deities, everyone doing various rituals throughout India. They needed to organize it somehow in order for them to understand. They pulled the Bhagavad Gita out of an epic poem called the Mahabharata and said, here you go, here's your Bible, Hindus, which is not right. Because after the 17th century is when you see artistic depictions of the Bhagavad Gita. It's very interesting if you look at history.
Yeah, that is very interesting. I had no idea about that because I've seen so many pictures of it, of course. And yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. I never knew that they were so recent.
Yes, because the British could not understand what Hindu philosophy was, because Hindu way of thinking is vast. It's vast and it's very difficult to organize and categorize it. For example, Kartikeya or Skandan is very much known as a Tamil deity. Nobody knows who Lord Muruga, Skandan, Kartikeya is the name for the same god in North India at all. He's not worshipped in North India at all, but Tamil Nadu, they love him. There's a huge festival for him and him alone.
Interesting. Okay, so it's like a deity that actually exists in South India and they don't worship that deity in North India at all?
Very rarely. He'll be known as Karthik. That's it.
Mm.
But not as much as importance as he's given in South India and Tamil Nadu, especially. In the North, Lord Rama, Ayodhya, because North India, Ayodhya and Dwaraka were the places Lord Krishna and Lord Rama are said to have been born. That's where the Bhagavad Gita was said to have been recited also. So those deities find more prevalence in North India than South India.
Interesting.
And then there's Ruksati, kite flying, or Holi. Holi is the festival of colors, where I'm sure you've seen pictures before in like National Geographic magazine, on TV, where people douse themselves with color to usher in spring.
Yeah.
South Indians don't celebrate that. We don't have anything like that. We each have our own New Year. We have Harvest New Year. We have a Harvest Festival, a Pongal. South Indian people have Pongal. They have Bogi. Malayali people have Bogi. So it depends. It really, really depends on your cultural background, your language, and the society that you grew up in.
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna ask you. You know, we've been talking a lot about diversity, and you said that was one of the words that you would choose if you wanted to describe Hinduism. And you also said oneness, which I'm very curious about. What can you tell us about that word, or why you chose it?
So oneness is that people, you know. Everyone has a negative view on Hinduism. Like the Western world has this negative view that Hindus believe in multiple deities, that they're polytheistic. But yes, which is not true. Because the thing is, it's like all of these deities lead to the same formless, genderless divine, which is called the Brahman, which exists in everyone and everything. But to realize the formless, genderless divine, it takes years of practice. It takes years of renunciation, years of renouncing your ego in order to connect with this divine. So that's why they have these visual aids in order to help them lead a better life, in order to cleanse your heart and lead a life of devotion and faith.
Okay, so basically all these different deities, all these multitudes of different deities that we see pictures of and even stories about, they're basically all manifestations of one
divine, one formless, genderless divine, known as the Brahman, Paramatman, the Brahman.
That's interesting. Now, I once heard that there are places where Hinduism is practiced where actually Buddha became one of their deities and Jesus became one of their deities. Is that?
It's true, because Buddha is considered the ninth incarnation of Lord Vishnu. So Lord Vishnu manifests himself on earth anytime righteousness is threatened. Lord Vishnu is that first he came as Matsya, the fish. Then as a tortoise, then as a boar, then so Matsya, Kurma, Varaha, which is a boar, then Narsimha is half human, half lion, Vamana, the dwarf man, Parshurama, the warrior, Rama, the prince, Krishna, the cowherd, right? Krishna, the author of the Bhagavad Gita, then Lord Buddha. So Buddha, he came at a time where righteousness was threatened because all of these the people who led Hinduism were becoming greedy and taxing the people, and the whole idea of bhakti or devotion to God was lost. So it's like then the Buddha came along. The ninth incarnation of Lord Vishnu, he came and he gave people the new word of leading a righteous life, of leading a life on the middle path, and to be kind and compassionate to one another, and stating that empty rituals do not lead you closer to God if there's no devotion or love behind it. So he is the ninth incarnation of Lord Vishnu. And the tenth incarnation of Lord Vishnu is Kalki, who's yet to come. Kalki avatar, he's going to be a man riding on a horse carrying a sword. So kind of like the Messiah, as what the Messiah in Jewish traditions. Or
Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Mm-hmm.
All religions have some very familiar stories and traditions shared between them. So this idea of the Messiah, of a man on a white horse, it's written in Jewish law someplace.
Oh yeah, of course. Sure. Mm-hmm. It's a very central theme in Jewish religion is the concept of a Messiah, of a savior, someone sent by God to come and, you know, save humanity.
And see, when you ask me about oneness, that's what being a Hindu is. It's written in our scriptures clearly in the Rig Veda, Ek Samtat, which means all is one. All faiths lead to the same divine is written in our scriptures. So a Jew could be a Hindu. A Muslim could be a Hindu. A Christian could be a Hindu. Do you understand what I'm saying? A Hindu can go attend church worship. A Hindu can go to Jumma prayers and still feel the same connection with the divine. If you see God as one, if you understand that God is almighty, all-powerful, all-encompassing, that everyone and everything belongs to it, then it makes you a more compassionate person. I don't understand why we have to have labels and definitions on things.
Well, actually, I'd love to ask you, and this is the perfect moment, I think, to do that. If there's any wisdom from Hinduism or from your culture or from your background that you think is relevant to what we're going through these days, to the virus or just generally to the situation that the world is in?
Sure. So, for example, right, Hindus believe, like right now we're living in the Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga means the age of destruction. Mankind will rip each other apart. That is written clearly in our scriptures. It says that mankind will forget about their connection to the divine, will forget about loving God and giving gratitude to God, and will be more interested in science and technology and machines. So that's what's happening right now. This global pandemic, it was written a long time ago. So it's like, that's how I try to wrap my brain around it, that we're still in the Kali Yuga. But to have faith, and have ultimate faith in the divine that he will pull, he, she, it, whatever you want to call it, will pull us through. And also, Ekam Sat in Sanskrit, meaning that which exists is one's one. Sages call it by various name. Also, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is a family. It's one of universal truth and value. And Satyameva Jayata, truth alone triumphs. And one that spreads peace and harmony among mankind. Sarva Bhavantu Sukhinaha, may all be happy. So every prayer in Hinduism, the last prayer, Om Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu, which means may the entire world and all its beings be happy.
Mm.
So Hinduism, it says right now in this pandemic, the prayers that says is one of universal prayer, universal truth, saying that the entire world is a family. We're all suffering in this together. There's not one man, woman, and child on this planet who hasn't been affected by coronavirus, whether they've lost loved ones or whether they're suffering from the disease or employment or emotional turmoil. Everybody is suffering because of this. But Hindu law states you have to understand that we are all one big family. There's no distinction between you and me. We're all one.
Hmm.
Well, Sangeeta, I want to say thank you so very much for taking the time to talk to me and to participate in this project. I really, really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. Let me know if you have other questions or need more information. I'm very, very happy to share.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks okay. So much. Have a great day.
No problem. You too. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
So that was Sangeeta Kausik, the Hindu chaplain at New York University, and also the founder of Isan Ishan Design Company. You can find their links in the description that goes with this episode. I always like to end off with a little bit of music, and it's interesting to note that the music of India does trace its roots back to Hindu spirituality, but today it's actually being played by Hindus, Muslims, and in fact by people all around the world. So we're going to hear a wonderful sitar player named Will Marsh, who lives in Northern California, and he will be playing Rag Bhairavi. Hope you like it. Thank you. So that was Will Marsh playing the sitar. And thank you so much, Will, for allowing me to use your music. And I want to say to everyone, thank you so much for being with us. And I will be speaking next week with Laughing Coyote, who is from the California Indian Mono tribe. And I highly recommend tuning in. Until then, this is Hear the World, and my name is Asaf Ophir. If you like this podcast, please tell your friends, please share, and have a wonderful week.